Okay, looks like we're all here. Thank you everyone for joining us. This is John with Casa, the safest way to store your Bitcoin, and I really appreciate you taking the time to sit in on this topic. What to do if your nation bans Bitcoin? It means different things all around the world, and of course many nations are at varying stages of this debate right now. And this will be a great conversation and a wonderful time for it. We're pleased to welcome our speakers Ron Stoner and Jameson Lopp, both with Casa, and our special guests NVK, or Rodolfo, as some of you may know him, from CoinKite, as well as Dave Bradley from the Bitcoin Well. And so thank you so much for joining us. And before we begin, I would like to remind everyone that this is going to be a theoretical discussion. We obviously don't know where you live around the world, and so we are not offering legal advice, tax advice, or financial advice. This is all theory, and we hope you enjoy this discussion. But speakers, if you could take turns and kind of tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure, I'll start. My name is Ron Stoner. I'm a hacker that has been in this space for over a decade now, and I've transitioned into more of the professional side of security. I'm currently the head of security at Casa, helping to provide our customers the peace of mind they need when it comes to their security in Bitcoin. And one of the fun parts of my job is thinking about these types of attacks and the response and what to do and how to help people secure their holdings. So this is a really fun topic. I'm happy to be here and elated to be on this panel with the rest of our guests. I think I'll throw that over to Jameson.
Hi, I've been building multi-sig self-custody Bitcoin wallets for about 7 years now, and originally my thesis many years ago for why I first got interested in Bitcoin was actually as a hedge against nation states and central banks, and basically the idea of having a completely alternative parallel financial system. So I think this is one of the fundamental aspects of the system that, you know, a lot of us are here for in the first place, and the ability for Bitcoin to be able to not only survive but thrive despite what the traditional authorities would like us to do, is it's important for us to keep in mind and continue discussing as the whole world keeps evolving and responding to the fact that Bitcoin continues to exist.
Hey, NVK, founded CoinKite over 10 years ago. We've been defending people's bags since then in multiple iterations. Right now we make Cold Card, which is a very hardened hardware wallet. And we make a few other Bitcoin products. And yeah, we just make sure that people don't lose money.
Hi, I'm Dave Bradley. I've been in Bitcoin since late 2010, and I founded my first Bitcoin company in 2013, and I've been buying and selling Bitcoin in Canada ever since. Most currently, I'm with a company called Bitcoin Well. We do primarily Bitcoin ATMs, and we're publicly traded on the Toronto Venture Stock Exchange, and I'm also widely known as the strongest and best-looking Bitcoin entrepreneur in Canada.
Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us. So I'd like to open up by acknowledging a little bit of the elephant in the room. Obviously, this topic is timely for a very important reason. In Canada, we're seeing some events where the government is beginning to interact with Bitcoin in a way that a lot of us aren't used to. And so Dave and NVK, if you could, what's the read from where you're standing from people that live there?
These things are not exactly how the media portrays, and also they're much worse and much better in certain ways, right? I mean, first of all, there is no like order or law or anything that I know of against Bitcoin itself. The concern was with this specific crowdfunding platform that was crowdfunding after a order to stop was made Essentially, the government made donating to this cause illegal. It's unlikely that it'll stand in court after all this martial law is done and whatever, but that's beside the point. Point is, they made it illegal to donate to this cause. They were able to distribute those funds to the truckers, as far as I know. And then what the government has is a list of addresses, really, right? And they're sort of like trying to tell, you know, through the usual sort of ways of telling all the governed, say, KYC exchanges and things like, listen, these addresses are addresses of interest. We would like you to stop if you have any transactions related to this. I don't believe they were successful in any of those cases, and I don't think there was any success regarding Lightning at all. So that's sort of like the objective state of things.
Yeah, so like Rodolfo said, like all of the regulated companies got the same notice. We got that notice from the RCMP, and there's like 34 addresses on there. What their notice notably is not is any requirement to do any kind of like blockchain analysis to go back and see, did this person just move these coins from one of those addresses? So it's not necessarily the most effective way to ban those addresses, but it's definitely the first time I think that we've seen like an organized effort to actively try to freeze Bitcoin in Canada.
They have sent those orders. If it comes from this address, you're sort of like required to stop it. But I don't think they're sophisticated enough to understand, you know, the millions of ways in which people circumvent those orders.
Yeah, I think the big differentiator is like every other time that we've been asked to freeze addresses that I know of, or that anyone's been asked to freeze addresses, it's always been tied to like a police investigation or a court order or something like that, rather than just like a blanket government edict. And so it's a little different in terms of how they got to this place, I think.
Thank you. So something that's on my mind about this topic is the situation in Canada. We're seeing something evolving in Russia with a bill that could be prohibiting self-custody. I'm not a lawyer in Russia, so I don't know for sure. But has Bitcoin always been on a collision course with this type of outright ban or really stringent regulation?
I think in my mind, the risk of some of the bans and regulation were greater in the beginning of Bitcoin's history. What I mean by that is the hydra hadn't grown large yet. And I think we're at a point now where if you end up cutting off one of the heads, three more are definitely going to grow in its place. So when we talk about regulation and bans, a lot of people immediately go to the worst case scenario. And what we've seen over history is the running joke on Reddit is that China has banned Bitcoin 18 times now, right? Some of them were a little bit more effective than others. Some of them were just PR for PR reasons. And when we're talking about bans, there's really a couple of levels of bans where they could declare a ban from a country level without really any enforcement, where they're just declaring that and hoping people comply. You could also see a ban where they're doing things that were referenced here, where there's white address lists and things that they need to block, or there may be transactions that are being flagged and stopped to and from exchanges and service providers. And then it can go a little bit further where it can reach out into your bank accounts now is what we're seeing if you've transacted with Bitcoin. And we saw this in the past where people would use bank accounts and a certain service provider or company would ban them because they were associated with Bitcoin activity. And then we can even go further where we can talk about the miners and hashing power and a lot of the censorship capabilities there that people have theorized about. So I think it's interesting to me today because it is an issue, but I think that the Hydra, like I said, has grown so large that we're going to be able to pivot and react if we start to see these things depending on the level of ban.
I guess one thing that we've been seeing here is, and I think it's a great example, because, you know, it is a G7 country, and, you know, G7 countries you'd think would be the last to sort of do something so stupid. And, you know, one fascinating thing to watch is it's very similar to like a Chavian sort of way of handling it, where you essentially put a massive blanketing order out or new law. And then what you do is you do selective enforcement, which is traditionally how it's been done in governments forever, where, you know, the government in place normally goes after people who they don't like with that selective enforcement, because, you know, ultimately they know it is impossible to ban it. So it's down to nonsense or for you to know that you are a person who's, you know, like not on their happy list. So you may find yourself in a position where you may need to either fight them in court or leave.
Yeah, I think specifying exactly what type of ban we're talking about is important, because there are many types of bans that can't really be enforced. Like, I don't think we're going to see, for example, an attempt to completely ban Bitcoin as a protocol at the network level. That would be kind of ridiculous to do, because once again, Bitcoin as a communications protocol can be facilitated over any number of different media, as actually Rodolfo is well aware, you know, having done some experiments on censorship resistance and alternative communications channels. And ultimately, you know, one of the reasons why there is this narrative that Bitcoin can't be banned is because it comes down to the sort of boots on the ground, like number of doors that need to be kicked down in order to really enforce this. And so that's why, especially if we are successful in continuing to increase the level of self-custody, getting, you know, the funds into the hands of the individuals rather than at a few centralized choke points, that's what makes Bitcoin more and more robust, because it becomes less and less likely that a nation state is going to care so much about this financial network that is, you know, flagrantly continuing to operate despite their proclamations that they're going to, you know, send law enforcement and military to the home of every suspected Bitcoin user.
Yeah, I mean, remember, right? Like, people can just pack up and leave, right? They'll remember their 12 words and they'll leave literally naked. You know, if we're still talking about, say, G20 kind of country, it's unlikely they will hold hostage, you know, like thousands of people just because they're suspected to have, you know, Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think if we're talking about like what kind of ban is likely in the short term, I think what they're going to end up trying to do here in Canada, and I can see this happening in other Western nations soon, is imposing further censorship requirements onto the centralized exchanges. So I think we're probably going to be in a space where as regulated companies, we have to block certain addresses, we have to block an ever-increasing list of people. And just like any government attempt to ban anything anywhere else in the world, what that's going to do is drive the formation of a black market. And I don't really see there being a lot of success at stopping people who really want to get Bitcoin to getting Bitcoin. I don't see it going any better than their attempts to ban drugs.
Yeah. One other differentiator that we have currently that we didn't have prior is that we're seeing nations and micronations and sovereign states start to adopt it. So if we do see bans from a nation's type of level from these different countries, does that mean El Salvador, for example, is going to follow suit, or are they going to continue to do their own thing? We didn't necessarily have that before. So as Bitcoin grows and the community matures, we're seeing more of this foundation be built where, you know, I think eventually you can make it to a point where we can say it doesn't matter if this country bans it, because, you know, this is our tool. It's a global tool. It wasn't designed for government's censorship or seizure. And I think we can continue to work to fulfill that prophecy.
You know, it's, you can look at financial markets as moat, right? So, you know, when a country makes a ban or something against an asset, right? There is a financial consequence to that if a lot of people hold that asset, especially if the financial markets hold that asset. Right. So as Bitcoin gets more adopted by, say, Fortune 500 companies, right, a government banning Bitcoin, say, for example, American government is so big banning Bitcoin would, you know, crash a lot of these stocks that have a lot of Bitcoin in their balance sheets, say in the near future. So, you know, nobody gets reelected if they crash the market. So, you know, that's why it's so good that you have these entities adopting Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think we're a long way from them trying to aggressively fully ban Bitcoin. I think that we might get that to that point someday where all these attacks at the pool and at the miner level start becoming a realistic possibility. But I don't think they're going to ban those things. I don't think they're going to go that far over censorship. I think that the only thing that's going to get the nation states of the world to eventually go that far is once they realize that they've permanently lost the ability to tax us through inflation. Then that's what I would expect to be a last-ditch effort to regain some measure of control.
We should also, as Bitcoin evolves and matures, they need to be specific about what is actually being banned, right? So are we talking about mainnet? Are we talking about something like the Lightning Network that was mentioned earlier? Because if I'm running my own full node, I have the capability to open peer-to-peer payment channels and still transact in some cases. So I may not be able to settle on a mainnet if there's issues or bans or things going on. But if I have liquidity and I have access, I can still use some of these tools. So my challenge would be, when these bans come up, what specifically is being banned? Is it everything under one umbrella or specific pieces of the protocol? And I think that complexity is going to grow over time as we see more BIPs implemented and more features and more tools built on top of Bitcoin.
Yeah, just like anything else, I expect the government will not be very good at this. And they will probably be a number of years behind on whatever layer or new technology they're trying to ban. And just like we saw with the Nunchuck response there, I can see them trying to ban things that they can't physically ban.
Yeah, I think we have finally the first type of technology that you truly shoot yourself in the foot if you go after it, right? You know, even the internet nowadays, you know, as a G20 interconnected financially country, you can't shut off the internet, right? That's something reserved for say developing world or poor countries, because they're simply not that interconnected. Now, when you have an asset that on top of the internet, like, you know, you can still transact even without the internet, just with more, you know, nonsenses, but you now have something that you're economically linked, right? The actual value that your citizens, your companies have is fully linked with the rest of the world in markets, right? You can't just debase, say, your currency like you did before. You cannot just debase the Bitcoin you have to, you know, maybe have a new trade agreement or something. So, you just seems anymore, or even what, you know, a lot of these countries did with gold. You can't create paper Bitcoin the same way you did with paper gold. The supply is just too small. And it'll be sort of fairly clear that somebody's trying to play that. So I think the days of blanket bans are pretty much done.
Thank you. So a good question to think about is if you kind of put yourself in the shoes of your average Bitcoiner, or maybe even a new Bitcoiner, and if you're somebody that's a little bit worried about this type of outright ban or something really strict coming down on you, what types of things should you be looking for in your current regime?
I mean, I think the easiest way to go about your life adopting Bitcoin and doing it in a way that is not susceptible to authoritarian overreach is to try to be, you know, native within the ecosystem. And by native, I mean, like, try to avoid these choke points, which are the, you know, the regulated on and off ramps. Because, like we've already said, we know that that is where the government pressure is going to end up, because the government, or really any authority, is going to try to exert the maximum amount of control that they can with the least amount of effort. So that's why choke points and bottlenecks, centralized areas of any ecosystem, that's where the pressure gets put. So if you are, you know, acting as a sort of full native Bitcoiner trying to help create a more circular economy. You know, you're accepting Bitcoin for stuff. You're paying for things with Bitcoin. Then I think that's going to automatically put you in the best possible position. Now, it's a bit more challenging to do because we're still very early, I think, in the process of mainstreaming the Bitcoin economy. But I think that really is the end goal. If we want people to be able to utilize the technology and the protocol without having all of these weak points, which are essentially the bridges between the traditional financial system and this new one.
You know, it's kind of fascinating because, stable coins essentially deprecated the proverbial Swiss bank account too for your USD stable needs, right? So now, you find people, lawfully engaging in, like full-on banking services outside of the legacy financial system, right? They're able to travel the world, have USD, have Bitcoin, and they can interchange between the two. They can find some more complex, riskier contracts out there to resolve some of the other volatility issues. But we are moving to a point now where in just a few more years, you're going to find credit card solutions. You're going to find still things that you may need to interface with the old world that, will be sort of guacamole, but you will be sufficiently serviced with the new financial solutions that may be or may not be regulated. And there is almost nothing governments can do about that because these people can also just move.
Do you think we're going to see a point where they force stablecoin operators or the protocols that they're on to regulate the users or transactions?
Yeah, but that wouldn't matter, right? That only matters if people are trying to go back to the legacy system, right? If they find, like in New Hampshire, if they find a landlord that's willing to accept, the direct asset like Bitcoin or some stablecoin as payment for the rent, that exchange that had the capabilities or the requirements of blocking that payment is no longer relevant.
But there's still an operator of the stablecoin, right? Somebody issued that. Somebody's running the protocol that it's on.
Sure. And that's today. But at the same time, I mean, how many Tether transactions have been censored? Like nearly none? What's going to happen is as some of this more riskier assets on riskier chains evolve and grow, you're going to have, USD based on Chinese treasuries. Right. And people are just going to keep on hopping between all these if their intent is to escape volatility with higher risk. But at the same time, they can just hold, BTC, or they can just pay BTC to the landlord. So, I think there's going to be a weird space in the next few years on how lawful people behave and how lawful people resolve some of the issues, because the advantage is going to be on the people who just move on from the state actor sort of lawful mentality. Not advocating for that, but that's really where the market is going, because state actors just can't move or can't let go of that control.
I think there is some things people can do until we get to that point where there are enough decentralized financial services to be able to live and survive. And I asked myself the same question or similar questions before this space, what actions would I take or what would I do to prepare if they came back and said the United States has banned all Bitcoin, right? And you have to cease using it immediately. And one of, I think, the viable methods that you can do if you are one of these people that's facing a ban or you're in one of these nations that decides to enact this, is one of the more viable methods is you can sit tight. I think I would immediately make sure I have GPG encrypted copies of my private keys or my seeds, and I would keep that somewhere hidden. And I probably would just lay low until the legislation or everything worked out. But then the other thing I think people should be aware of, I'm a paranoid security guy, so I always try to think about this stuff, right, in the worst case scenario and then hope for the best. But from a preparation standpoint, there's 6 or 7 things people can do to prepare for this if you are worried about it. And I think the first one we saw up in Canada is if your bank account is being linked to Bitcoin activity or transactions, that could be suspect to being frozen. So this was one of the steps that people used to do in the early days, is that they had multiple bank accounts if you have that luxury, where if one of your bank accounts goes down, you're not totally dead in the water. You're spreading that risk out a little bit. And that's something people could do today before the bans happen. The other thing you can do is keep your non-KYC coins in cold storage. And some good examples of non-KYC coins would be ones that you've mined yourself, where if you're lucky enough to hold physical Bitcoin, Cassatius coins, or some of those tokens and representations, those physical totems, those coins haven't moved in years and haven't gone through KYC systems and aren't associated with any transaction activity. So adding those types of things, I think, are going to demand a premium when we do see these types of regulations and bans. And they do today currently, just due to some of the checks exchanges do. I also recommend people keep some liquidity in some Lightning wallets. Maybe not a ton, because it's still a new technology and we're working out a lot of the issues. But if you have money in the Lightning wallet and we do see a ban on mainnet, there may be code, there may be things we can do with being able to still transact or settle those on a new chain. Number four is kind of touchy, where you do want to make sure you have enough funds in your local fiat currency for an emergency. And what I mean by that is enough to eat and potentially move and get to somewhere where you can reload your seeds on a hardware wallet or transact with your Bitcoin in another country. And then the other thing people should do is just practice safe operational security, OPSEC. If your government's banning Bitcoin and they're serious about it, they're going to be grabbing logs and keywords off your Facebook, your LinkedIn, your Twitter, and trying to identify those people, as we said, selective enforcement, right? Who are the whales? Who are the known vocal personalities in this space? Who are the people that are throwing the middle finger to the government? Because they're going to make an example out of them to try to get everybody else in line. So these are the types of things I think people need to think about. And lastly, if you are a type of person that has enough money and availability for dual citizenship, right there, you're decentralizing your risk to if one nation bans Bitcoin, you can go to your other nation and transact and do what you need to do without having to worry about running amok of that ban or the government.
So I've got an interesting exercise, and we'll see what the response is to this. So imagine you wake up tomorrow and through some weird twist of fate, you're a central banker, and your premier or president has told you to crack down on Bitcoin. How would you attack it?
I think from a central bank perspective, the best way to go after Bitcoin would be going back to the gold standard.
It's totally true. I mean, there really isn't much, because the financial incentives are really on side of Bitcoin, right? This is one of those moments that you can choose to embrace it and take advantage of it and be a first comer and really benefit from being that first comer, or you're just going to essentially try to fight and perish. It sounds a little too optimistic or too strong, but that's really what this is.
I think I would provoke infighting within the community, because that's the typical spy playbook, is cause dissension from within, distract people, keep their eyes off the mission and the prize. And these examples in the community are ones that we should all look at and rally behind, because this is our chance to stand united and say, no, we won't stand for these bans. No, we won't stand for these types of regulations. This is our tool, right? This is how we're going to use it. So these are eye-opening examples. But if I was to do that, I would try to do some spy ops from inside.
I mean, we saw that, right? I mean, they failed miserably trying to change variables. And, you know, sure, they caused a little bit of strife, but people eventually move on. And I think the size of the space now and the amount of economical capacity sort of, you know, negates all this sort of like usual approach they have always done against open source, right? Which is, you know, try to create drama.
I don't know. I would probably investigate market manipulation. I mean, if you think about it, with the central banks essentially having the money printer, it seems like if you really wanted to, you could probably, you know, take on the position of being the most malicious, huge Bitcoin whale market maker in existence.
I mean, it would be pretty funny if they printed a lot, bought a lot, and then dumped.
Yeah, the problem with that idea is that you just give more power to the Bitcoiners while you're doing that, right? Because you increase all of our purchasing power as they drive the price up.
That's an interesting segue to my next question. So for those that aren't familiar with it, what is the Streisand effect and how would that interact with Bitcoin? Why does the Streisand effect take place?
Well, you can't cheat the market, right? I mean, there's only so far you can do. And that is true for the market of ideas or financial assets. It's just that we have a thing that everybody wants. And governments are now at odds with the markets, right? They're trying to go the other way with censorship and manipulation of markets. But we now have this thing that forces their hand. So essentially, every time they try to do something with it, it just strikes an effect and something else bigger happens, right? Like, it's not perfect akin, but, you know, they just can't delete Bitcoin off the internet anymore.
Yeah, I mean, once it gets big enough that they can't ignore it, they have to start issuing these proclamations, right? And so the proclamations inevitably result in the Streisand effect because now the media picks up on it and of course, they're going to start spinning it and put their narrative on it. And I think one of the most annoying things that I've seen from the past few weeks is I saw quite a few mainstream media articles that said that the Canadian government had frozen a bunch of Bitcoin wallets. And of course, we all know that's not the case. They only proclaimed that they wished that they could freeze a bunch of Bitcoin wallets.
A good historical example of the Streisand effect is when China did their most recent ban in October, and it came out in the news, and everyone thought it was going to be doom and gloom, and the price actually rose. So we saw some of the highest price activity, whether it was correlated or not. Something tells me the news stories and people's awareness of all of that got them moving a little bit quicker. So I think that's a good example of the inverse effect happening.
Yeah, I'm probably in several hundred or maybe thousands of people's phones as Bitcoin Dave. And I'm the guy that they text. I'm sure the rest of you guys all have this as well, where every person you've ever met texts you anytime something happens to do with Bitcoin. And usually what ends up happening is those people text when the price is going way up. But this week I've been getting a lot of those texts because I think people are starting to see, what is actually useful about Bitcoin and what kind of like real world scenario you can, like a normal person can end up in where they might want money that the government can't freeze.
Yeah, I mean, look at what Trudeau did with the bank freezes, right? They had to try to walk that back because the net effect of this kind of stuff is that, any person with a brain goes, hey, if they can arbitrarily pick on some old lady because she donated $20 to some cause that she doesn't even fully understand, right? They're going to come after my actual wealth. And so these people all started to wiring out. I mean, you ask around, like anybody with money was starting to get the money out of the country, right? And what's fascinating about that is that you can't really save face after something like that. It's going to take years for people to have any sort of security or respect for the Canadian banking system.
How would the risk of a ban, how does it differ from those that have KYC coins and those who don't have KYC coins? What is the practical impact of that?
Say another layer in my mind of privacy and security, where I have my holdings and I secure them how I want and I take custody of those and nobody needs to know. Whereas if I've interacted with an exchange that has my KYC information, any government or legal entity can compel them to share that information without my knowledge. And that does happen, as we referenced earlier in the call, with different law enforcement requests and seizures and things that happen. I would advise people that if you're the type of person that is privacy or security conscious, to not interact with these KYC sites and services. We've been preaching that for a while. And even Kraken just came out and said recently, Jess Powell said, that you know, that is happening and it's going to continue to happen as time goes on. So it's another layer in the security and privacy onion of how far do you want to go and what level of control do you want to retain over your assets.
You know, the like going after the exchanges is the only knob governments have. So they're going to turn that one all the way to 100, right? And, you know, people can still legally buy it. I doubt they will be illegalized to buy it. They're just going to have like further reporting sort of requirements. And, you know, as people sort of take custody of them, it's so important to take custody of your Bitcoins because, you know, not your keys, not your coins. You know, you can weather it out, as Ron mentioned, you know, just sit and wait, because if you don't do anything, more often than not, you'll likely be in a legal position where you're not breaking any laws or doing anything. Of course, check with your lawyer. But like, so, you know, Bitcoin is playing the wait game, right? We can cockroach, we can hold longer than they can stay solvent.
I think that was also still true even after all of the Chinese bans, you know, even after I think they basically forced most of the exchanges to shut down. If I recall correctly, it was still legal to own Bitcoin and transact in it. It's just that they basically shut off all of the you know, regulated financial institution on-ramps and off-ramps.
I think a good question to ask yourself, too, we always like to ask, like, what if your nation bans Bitcoin? What if your nation bans your local currency? Like, what if the United States comes out and says the dollar is no longer a currency, or the world decides that we're not going to transact into the dollar anymore? And when you think about what steps would you take immediately, or what systems would collapse, or what would end up happening, I think that's how I look at it with Bitcoin. Like, what steps would I take to make sure I can ensure my survivability for the short term and the long term if the inverse was to happen?
You know, when I was a kid in Brazil, the government went and did the bail-ins, right? Did a haircut. And that was right after, I think, two or three failed currencies that we had only 24 hours to exchange back to the new currency. You know, this is the game that, you know, these are the tools and the game that they know how to play, right? The difference now is that we have an asset that's fully fungible and fully sellable, right? And I think they, you know, to a certain extent, they do understand that. I don't think they are in a position yet or do not see the bright side of essentially acknowledging that Bitcoin is not bannable and that there is very little much they can do nowadays against capital controls, right? So, you know, just being able to secure your asset goes a long way.
Yeah, I think they're already kind of on the road to that right now with all the money printing going on in the world. It just hasn't really registered yet that these currencies are dying. And the difference is this time we can switch to the new money well in advance. So we don't only have 24 hours.
For some reference, right, even in Canada, you know, like I would sort of go out on a limb and say that, like, at least probably half of the wealthy who have liquidity, liquid money in the bank, are actually holding USD, right? I don't think non-businesses hold CAD as much as people think they do. So even if we saw the capital flight out, you would see it as USD and you wouldn't see it reflected in the CAD being sort of demolished in the Forex, right? So that's not different than all these people holding the BTC. Like, it would not be clear to them what's happening. I think a lot of the stuff is not as visible anymore to government as they think that it is.
Something else that we're seeing making headlines right now is the prospect of banning self-custody. And the only analog I can think of that is when you travel across the country with hordes of cash and you get stopped and the police takes it from you. When we think about banning self-custody, are we looking at civil forfeiture? Are they messing with the supply chain on hardware wallets? What would you anticipate is their goal?
That's my challenge to that, is how do you enforce it at that level? Where, you know, do we have to send Gestapo to people's houses to do searches? One of the things that I remember vividly from my childhood was the cable television descramblers. right? You would go over your friend's house or your uncle's house, and they'd have that little black box. It would give you all the pay-per-view channels on cable and the whole channel guide and everything descrambled, and it was just a chip. And they fought that for years, the cable company did, because they said they were losing revenue. And in reality, you know, they were making profits hand over fist. But every once in a while, they'd send out a stinger signal or send out a cable technician to do some surveillance and check to see if anybody was using those. But I remember for years, for decades at least, people got away with that, right? Because you can't enforce that on that low level. And I doubt that they're going to be training police to be able to identify hardware wallets and USB drives and things like that. As we mentioned earlier, the government's slow, they're inefficient. They may eventually get their way, but they're not very good at doing things.
You know, it's kind of funny because, you know, we actually make hardware wallets in Canada, and it's, I'm still fully unconcerned, because, you know, it's still a lawful country. I'm entitled to make a product. They've tried banning encryption before back in the day. How did that work? Didn't work. So, you know, they can't really replace the chips that we have in quantity. Good luck to them. The source code is fully viewable and verifiable, so they can't really do anything against that. I can make this product in any other country in the world. It's a simple board to make. So, like, you know, if they came after us, it would actually be quite amazing because, you know, again, they're just revealing their hand, and we would know exactly the extent that they could go about it. All this physical attacks are often very targeted because they're extremely costly and they have high failure rate, right? So it's very hard to do something that is against, like, everybody, right? I mean, them banning people from downloading free movies on torrent failed miserably. The way that diminished was by the market meeting the demand, which was to lower the cost and find different business models, right? So I think essentially what we're going to see is going to be very similar to the movie or music industry, where governments are going to have to accept that they no longer have the monopoly on money, and they're going to have to compete.
And it should be added that it's very easy to hide an open dime because of those rounded corners. But I think where we're going to see this crackdown happen, if they try it, is going to be again at those centralized choke points with companies like us, with the regulated exchanges. And they might try to make it so that we're not allowed as a regulated entity to send bitcoins to a wallet that is not verifiably linked to a regulated custodian or another regulated exchange. So that's something that we're definitely going to fight pretty hard if they try to put that in here in Canada. But I think that's like, that's the only even remotely realistic way that they can go about banning self-custody.
Well, look at the Swiss solution, right? So in Switzerland, they have this thing where if you wanna withdraw your funds from an exchange, a regulated exchange, you need to sign. You either have to go to a custodial wallet, or you have to prove that you own the key. But that's idiotic because you can prove that you own the key and then move the funds right after, like 10 over times, and then you had a bolt accident. Like, these things are so ineffective, and the cost of them to society, like in actual dollars, are you know, they're absurd.
The question is, what does it actually mean to ban self-custody? At the very lowest level, what that would be saying is, you are not allowed to have a large random number in your possession. And we know, just due to the nature of information and information wanting to be free, and the internet and all these other communications channels that make it impossible to truly stop the flow of information, is that it's just a fool's errand. And I think basically, to go back to what Dave said earlier, is that sure, they can implement those mandates and they can go to the choke points of the regulated institutions and say, you know, you have to abide by that. But what is that really going to do? It's just going to cause a split. It's going to result in those regulated institutions being their own walled gardens. And meanwhile, the rest of the world goes on as a, you know, quote-unquote black market, which is, of course, just more government propaganda for a free market.
Jameson touched on the point exactly. You can ban Bitcoin, but I don't have physical possession of Bitcoins, right? My Bitcoins live on chain. And as he said, I have some random numbers that I control that allows me to sign a message to move the ownership of those coins, right? So like when you talk about bans, and we got a little bit into this earlier with semantics, and you were saying banning Bitcoin, are you actually banning the holding of private keys or the ownership of Bitcoin? And this gets into a really tricky area, because to my knowledge, if you ever have a search and seizure or a warrant, you know, served against you, it needs to explicitly define the physical items that that team is there to look for. So are they coming to seize numbers? Is that what we're talking about here when we're talking about these types of local enforcement?
You know, personally, I think they would just use similar like common law that we have for beneficiary, right? That's how corporations work. So, you know, they'll just say you're the beneficiary of that Bitcoin on the chain, right? So you have signing authority over that on the chain. And then we have already like plenty of case law on that. But that's still like, you know, are you going to ban, you know, people from having signing authority on something? Like it becomes very complicated because, you know, it's still your property. It's, you know, and now it's free speech because it's money. So it's going to, they are on an uphill battle they can't win.
Yeah, it gets into the realm of banning thoughts.
Good point. So I have one more question before I open up to Q&A. I'll give people some time to request. But so something that we talk about in the Bitcoin community is the prospect of the boating accident. Theoretically, if Fed or investigator knocks on your door and you say, I lost my Bitcoin in a boating accident, how does that actually play out?
Yep. I think that depends if they know if you have it prior or not. When someone's knocking on your door, you know, it's already kind of worst case situation where you don't know what they know, what information you put out there, whether or not they're asking you leading questions or false questions to get you to either admit or deny something based on their goal. So that's a tricky one, because if they're coming for you, they probably already know information or have justification to do it. And if you're lying or trying to deceive people, I think then you're putting yourself in deeper trouble, depending on how you react to that. So I would think that preventing that situation to begin with and not making yourself a target is probably better advice than how do I actually deal with that situation when it transpires, because I don't actually have good advice. It's going to be very much situational dependent.
You know, they do have a lot of law and orders to produce, right? And in a way, if they suspect or the judge agrees that they suspect that you have something that they want to know or have, and the court is in agreement with the law, they would just hold in contempt, right? So they'll let you rot for quite a while before they let you go. So, as funny as, you know, this is a good meme, it's probably not a very good strategy.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, remember, it's not possible to prove a negative, right? You can't prove that you lost your coins, though. Here's an interesting possibility. I haven't really heard people think of this situation, but I wonder if you really wanted to make sure that your coins can't be seized, the only way, like 100% foolproof way I'm aware of doing that is to either burn the funds, you know, send them to a burn address, so then literally no one in the world can ever access them, or to do a time lock on them. You know, you could put a 10, 20, 30 year time lock on it, and then you could even, you know, cryptographically prove to the government that your funds are quote unquote frozen, and there's nothing that any government authority can do about that. But otherwise, it's very tricky. I would say, at least in the United States, the best legal advice when it comes to, you know, talking to law enforcement is don't. Anything that is said to law enforcement should happen through an attorney, because they have a much better idea of what they're doing and what you potentially expose yourself to whenever you say anything. Otherwise, if you do say something like, I lost all my Bitcoin, then you're putting yourself in a very tenuous situation, especially if at any point those coins touched any KYC services or could otherwise be traced to you, because if you ever want to spend them again in the future, there's a high likelihood that that activity is going to raise some red flags.
Yeah, and I think it's going to come down to the same thing again, where they'll probably end up regulating that at the exchange level. And if somebody is deemed to have had a bullying accident and they don't feel like going with a wrench attack, then they would probably put surveillance on you at the exchange level and say these exchanges must freeze whatever funds come in up to a certain level, just like we saw with the truckers.
Thank you. So at that point, we'll move to Q&A, and I'll just quickly reset the room for those that joined after we started. This is a theoretical discussion. We're not advocating that anybody go break any laws. We're just talking theory here. Justin, I added you to the stage. Do you have a question for the panel?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I'm a bit of a Bitcoin pleb, so my understanding, I'm still learning about Bitcoin and everything, but I'm actually going to be speaking to my parliament in just over half an hour, and I have 5 minutes to really, give a Bitcoin pitch. But really, the main point was to protest this the central bank digital currencies that we're going to be testing soon in the country. So yeah, I was just wondering if what would your 5 minute pitch be to kind of deter a country from using central bank digital currencies and adopting Bitcoin?
I would try to enlighten them that this is a technology that is sound and secure and has been going strong well over 13 years now, whereas CBDCs are very much new and untested and theoretical, and there's a lot of back and forth and pros and cons to them. I would let them know that, a lot of governmental programs, while you do, you need to be in a respectful position when you're talking to them, obviously, with this. But while they do implement these things, they're not always implemented correctly. And if you look at the private sector and industry, a lot of times they do things better, right? So why would we want to create a new technology when we already have one out there that is working, is into people's hands, and is decentralized and secure? What's going to be better?
Give them the example of CompuServe versus the internet. There's very little incentive to create a network of just one node, right? Bitcoin already exists. Is a network that they will capture a lot more value because they will be early. And, if they try to make their own thing, it's just going to be another version of their current state money that will likely go down the drain anyways.
Yeah, and I think the first point I would make would be that as a payment network, Bitcoin is inevitable. It's very difficult, as we've been discussing, to censor and all but impossible to stop when it comes to payments. And that by embracing it at that very surface level for payments, there's actually a possibility for the country to bring in investment and innovation like we're seeing in El Salvador right now. So that's like the toes in the water. But I think the real eventual outcome for any nation state is to start moving away from this unlimited money printing churn and start separating financial policy from monetary policy. And whichever country starts doing that and starts like meaningfully accumulating Bitcoin to use as their national currency eventually is probably going to be the richest country in the world.
Yeah, I think approaching it from a first mover advantage standpoint is important, because any given country that has its own central bank and its own currency, it's going to be highly incentivized to keep doing that and, continue to have as much control over as many different levers as possible. And so it may seem stupid to give up a lot of those points of control in order to adopt this new technology, but I would think it's new technology, but I would think of it as instead being one of the first early adopters of what will eventually become the digital gold standard and will be greater than any one country. It will be the global standard that works because no single nation state can manipulate it.
It also won't know the technical benefits, right? So what we're looking at is very similar to when we were all walking around with Nokia phones in our pockets and we had the T9 SMS text everybody. And within the span of a decade, due to the entrepreneurship and ingenuity of some of the Silicon Valley techs that were out there, we're all walking around with smartphones now, which kind of blew our world apart. And it's hard to think about the pre-smartphone world when we were all walking around, how we communicated, how we got access to our work email, how we did the things that we needed to do on a daily basis. So what you should do is you should explain to them that we are at that precipice right now where we can make a choice. You know, do we want to keep Nokias in our pocket or do we want to advance and get into the smartphone world? And I think if you look at that, Bitcoin is the smartphone of money, right? Why would you shy away from that?
Thank you for your question and good luck with your talk with Parliament.
Thanks for that, everyone. It was great.
So this next person I added to the stage, I love this handle, Noodle Nakamoto. Do you have a question for the panel?
Yeah. Cheers. Thank you. Ron said that if possible, don't use centralized exchanges to acquire your Bitcoin, etc. But for those of us that did, and I'd imagine there's a fair few, is mixing the only option to get privacy back? And it's kind of a two-part. That's kind of part one. Part two is sort of, reflecting on what just happened with Wasabi and that kind of flaw that was discovered with people mixing, I think, previous UTXOs with new UTXOs, etc. After that happened, how much confidence do you guys have with, things like Whirlpool from Samurai? And the mixing facility that's in Sparrow Wallet, for instance.
I'll be quick. It's a bit controversial, maybe. So I think people need to be careful with privacy LARPing. A lot of these tools are actually very good if you do it well. I think many, if not most, of the average users will likely screw themselves if. Trying to use these tools. And you also have to be careful with your local laws regarding mixing and things like that, because you could essentially be saying that you're doing something wrong, right? I think they're fantastic. Like Join Markets is fantastic. There's a lot of good tools out there, but I think people need to understand more before they sort of jump in and put their life savings into something that could cause them harm.
Yeah, 100%. Straight up, I'll be honest, I wouldn't know how to use some of those services. I've read up on them. It's just that from a privacy standpoint, if you've got coins that you've already got from an exchange and you just want, you're not a criminal, you just want privacy. What's the best way to go about it if you just want to kind of give yourself a clean record, almost as if you'd mine the coins yourself?
I think separation is probably the best thing in your case, because you've already acquired the coins, they've already gone through an exchange, there's already probably KYC information tied with them. That's not the worst thing in the world if you're not a criminal and you're not trying to scam people and you're not doing money laundering, right? If you're just transacting with it or you're buying it to hold or speculate or you love the technology and just want to contribute to it, that's great. When you start to introduce mixing with that, though, it gets to be a problem, because mixing is not just the one and done type of function or software that you run once and then you're in the clear. You have to do a lot of upkeep continually, where you're making sure that you're keeping your mixed outputs and inputs and things like that separate from other ones, and that you're continuing to not mix and match any of those things. And it's a lot of work. So what I would say is, if you're the type of person where you're not a criminal and you're not worried about that, you probably don't have too much to worry, but you do have the privacy aspect still. And I think with more protocol improvements and signature aggregations and all cool new technology enhancements, you will get more of that privacy over time. But the problem you're going to encounter if you go to mix it and you don't do it correctly is they're going to be able to demix it and find your identity anyway in the case that you're being targeted. And then the second thing is, if you do mix them and then you try to transact with those coins, they may get flagged, right? Even if you're using them for legal purposes, because it's a few hops away from the mixer, or it's being identified as part of different coin join processes that are out there, things like that, you could be unintentionally making your life harder, right? So I think, again, sitting tight and just waiting. If you have the coins, there's things you may be able to do in the future to help kind of add some more of the privacy benefits back to it.
That's a really interesting point. And I suppose taking the other side of the kind of coin, if you will, that means any Bitcoin user, if I've understood you correctly, could also be exposed to that kind of overreach if they've interacted with a mixed coin, you know, that they've never know, they just didn't know about. Is that correct?
Go ahead, Bradley.
Yeah, like, I think it's possible. That would be a bit of a stretch based on the current technical and knowledge base that we're seeing from governments right now. But there might be some requirements at some point. I would take the position that your KYC coins that you have are probably going to be fine. And that said, it's not a bad idea to get some non-KYC coins as a hedge to that idea. And it's also one of those things where, like, in the worst case scenario, if what we're describing here, in the very unlikely scenario where you've got people kicking down doors looking for those who are supposed to have Bitcoins, you know, you probably want to have something to give them in that case. And so having those non-KYC coins would be kind of like a hedge on top of your KYC coins.
And, you know, another interesting aspect of this is, you know, mixing is just one sort of like thing. There's also a million non-KYC sort of like, you know, digital contracts out there that people will sort of make legitimate investments in and then, you know, withdraw legitimately. And, you know, like, it's no longer the original coins, right? It's the same as sending to an exchange and taking it out. So, you know, it's one of those things that, like, they can write it into law, but, like, good luck enforcing it.
Other people are going to tell you to, like, throw it on the Lightning Network or send it into a Monero black hole, privacy coin black hole, and then bring it back out. But even some of those types of things, the tooling, and when you do that stuff, it goes on chain, right? So even if the tooling doesn't necessarily exist today or isn't as optimized as it is today, you know, that doesn't mean in 2 years they're not going to be able to trace things more efficiently than they can today with some of the Chainalysis software that's out there.
Sergio, do you have a question for the panel?
Yeah, thanks for bringing me up. I was just going to go back to what Dave said earlier about just kind of, I know diversifying is kind of a stupid word to use. I mean, it's a little bit old for investors, but it probably is a good idea to split up your coins and consider different, you know, different avenues to put them in with KYC and no KYC. So I've been mining since the summer, and that's kind of a no KYC way to do it. And of course, you got to have some capital to maybe get started with that. Compass offers a service. I don't know if anybody would like to do that or if they have capital to do it, but it's a good way to get kind of quasi no KYC coins. So I'm doing that, but I'm also a Casa customer, and I don't know if this is a question. I think someone brought it up the other day in either as a Twitter space, maybe as a podcast, but what do you guys do with your node? What do you guys do with the coins when I send it into my Casa wallet? I have a 2 of 3 multi-sig. So I don't know, if do you guys mix the coins when you put it in there, or what do you guys actually do?
Well, we do get asked fairly regularly, you know, if Casa is going to implement any sort of coin join or mixing or whatever. And short version is, it's actually kind of antithetical to the security model that we offer. Like, if you want to be doing coin mixing, that's a very interactive process. So you have to have those coins on a hot wallet that can be regularly signing these large coin join transactions. So it's not something that we've even really looked into implementing, because, you know, it's automatically putting your coins into a lower security model than we try to offer by default. Of course, it's technically possible for us to do a lower security model than we try to offer by default. And then even past that, there would be further questions of like exactly which mixing protocol would we use and what would the coins be mixed with and what are the potential legal ramifications around all of that. So yeah, it's fairly, I would say, fairly low on the priority list for us to implement ourselves. What I normally recommend people do is that I don't think it really makes a ton of sense to be constantly mixing your coins. It may make sense to mix them, before you deposit them into Casa. I don't really think so either. Really, the only time that I think it makes the most sense to mix your coins is when you are about to make a payment on chain. If you want to be able to make a payment and do it in such a way that the person can't just plug that transaction into a block explorer, follow it back a few hops, and basically see your entire wallet, I think that's the time when doing coin join makes the most sense for the average person.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. And then I guess one other thing is just like a comment. I've been a Casa customer for a little over a year now. But like I said, I wanted to diversify, so I started doing the mining. But there are times when, I'm looking at price, and if I see a trigger where it's like a 20% dip or even 15 or 10% dip, I'll go buy coins and I'll send it straight over to my Sparrow wallet. And I don't know if anybody has played around with the Sparrow wallet, but they now have a mixing tool in there for coin join. And it's kind of nice because you can coin join, but then you can have it mix coin join and then directly put into another wallet that you create on Sparrow. So there's a way to kind of diversify the way that you're mixing it there. So you're not mixing and then it's stuck there and then you got to send it again. And then, you just mix them and now you're sending it. So now they can backtrace that. So there's kind of a cool way for you to mix it and then automatically send it to like a cold card or a Trezor or something like that.
Thanks for the suggestion. Salamonte, added you to the stage. Do you have a question for the panel?
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. So I guess my question, in the event of there's a ban, I'm trying to assess kind of the risk to the collaborative custody model, right? So I'm also a customer of Casa. So I can see a situation kind of like what's happening in Canada. Like let's say things get so bad here in the U.S., wouldn't it be possible for them to just say to Casa, hey, we're going to kill your mobile apps. So all Casa customers, all of a sudden, they're not going to be able to use their Casa app. And then they will basically prevent Casa from signing any transaction. So all of this collaborative custody customers will be forced to kind of use the kind of recovery method, right? We're using Electrum and doing it on their own. So do you see that as a risk where the government can say to Casa, for example, you cannot sign any transactions for your customers and then shut down your app? Would that be a possibility?
It's always technically a possibility, and it's something that you should consider as an edge case. And this is why we've designed it so that the app and our servers are not a single point of failure. I think it's a pretty big edge case. Like, if Canada came to us and told us to shut everything down, we would definitely discuss that with legal counsel before deciding how to respond. Like, I'm not even sure if they would have the legal authority to put that sort of pressure on us. So could an authority compel, just assume it's United States government, since that's where we're based, could we be compelled, not to sign transactions? I would just assume that Casa as a company gets completely nuked. That is the worst case scenario, whether it happens due to a government action or due to some other weird environmental edge case, doesn't really matter. And that's when it's important for you to be able to follow that sovereign recovery process. And I really encourage all of our customers to do it now, do it ahead of time, make sure that you're comfortable with being able to do it, even though you will probably never have to. It's just like practicing any other sort of emergency drill. You want to make sure that you are comfortable with the fact that you have the ability to follow those instructions. So yeah, I mean, it's a worst case scenario, but it's still one that we want to not end up causing catastrophic loss to our customers if it does happen.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I obviously that's not going to happen through like law passed through Congress, right? It's going to be something where, you know, it's declared emergency and then, you know, abusing the laws, right? That's kind of the situation that I'm potentially anticipating, because it happened in Canada, right? And I never thought it would happen in Canada, and it did. So that's why I'm... So the last question I have, I know we talk a lot about KYC versus non-KYC coins. Wouldn't we want to be, increasing, like, because the more we use as Bitcoiners, right, use these tools to Whirlpool or CoinJoin, wouldn't that kind of force the government to say, yes, that's dirty money, versus us Bitcoiners cooperating, doing it the right way in KYC, paying our taxes, and then incorporating that as part of the ecosystem? Just want to get your thoughts. I see it being promoted a lot, which is a good thing, but I think we still, you know, as responsible Bitcoiners, we should be still paying taxes. That way, you know, because if the majority is not paying taxes and using these tools to not pay taxes, then we're asking basically the government and Congress to kind of attack us, right? So wanted to get your thoughts on that.
I think there's a couple different issues at play here. One of them is the just fungibility of Bitcoin in general. And the unfortunate aspect of the fact that very few people actually use mixers means that if you are using these privacy-enhancing tools, as of now, it actually makes you a bigger suspect. Even if you're not doing anything illegal, it will, you know, if anything comes up with a Chainalysis company or any sort of regulated exchange that's looking at the history of your funds within several hops, then the fact that your funds have gone through privacy-enhancing tools actually increases your risk score and makes it more likely that the regulated institutions will decide not to do business with you. In an optimal world, we would all be using CoinJoin and various privacy-enhancing tools, and it would be so pervasive that it would just not be tenable for any of these institutions to refuse to do business with us, because they would be basically cutting off their own foot. Unfortunately, I don't see us getting to that point anytime soon. On the other hand, from a sort of taxation perspective, I think that's less of an issue of using privacy-enhancing tools. I think that probably comes down more to money laundering than taxation, and I suspect the money launderers who, you know, they're basically trying to clean the proceeds from other criminal activities just so that they can spend them. I doubt that they're going to be paying taxes on them either way, but regardless, like when it comes to taxes and, you know, paying your capital gains and whatnot, I don't really think that on-chain or really any technical privacy considerations or any like AML or non-KYC stuff even really matters when it comes to the taxation stuff, because what's ultimately going to happen is if you want to realize a non-negligible amount of gains that you've gotten from investing in these systems, you're going to be buying property, and you're going to be increasing your lifestyle, and it's those things that end up getting attention from the tax authorities. You know, if they see you acquiring property and there's a mismatch between what you have reported and your basically level of lifestyle, There's really nothing that any on-chain or technical privacy is going to do to help you when it comes down to that.
No, thank you very much. That was quite helpful. Thanks for the opportunity, guys.
Thank you. And Infinity Long, I added you to the stage if you have a question for the panel. And this will be our last question for the day. Thank you so much for joining us. Infinity Long, take it away.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. So I'm kind of new to the space, and you guys keep mentioning KYC. What do you guys think are like the best non-KYC methods to acquire Bitcoin?
This question comes up a lot, I think, in a lot of the spaces we've done because it's more topical now. Some of the ones we've mentioned here, like if you run your own miner and you're mining your own Bitcoin, you don't need to report that to anybody, right? You didn't need to put an ID on file to accrue that. So that's one way you can do that. There's some interesting games that are actually being built on the Lightning Network, and I don't suggest that for like trying to get any significant amount of value. It's more akin to like viewing ads on can do that. There's some interesting games that are actually being built on the Lightning Network, and I don't suggest that for like trying to get any significant amount of value. It's more akin to like viewing ads on the internet to get a couple cents here and there, but you can pull a couple hundred Satoshis for free with various games and mobile apps, and even some of the savings apps, the Fullguard and some of the other various ones that are out there, Lolly and a few others, you can spin for sats or you can get bonus sats per day. So if you're the type of person where you do that for 5 minutes every morning as part of your routine, you can start to build up a little tiny stack. And it's not going to be anything significant, but you are getting KYC-free Bitcoin that could be worth a little bit more in the next decade or so. So you want to consider those types of things. The other thing I always tell people is labor, right? If you have a skill set and you want to do a job for somebody, if you're a security professional and you do a penetration test, I've done those for Bitcoin before as a payment, right? And while I was doing it through my business and legally and declared it on taxes, depending on where your jurisdiction is or who you are, there may be different laws or reporting requirements for exchange for payment for skills and labor. So I would look into those types of things to see what those limits are, because there are ways that you can act within the system and do it. The last one people are going to recommend is local Bitcoins, and I think that that has changed over the past couple of years and is not as a viable method. But if you start attending Bitcoin groups, meetups, things like that, you will start to hear of or discover opportunities to make purchases that may not have to go through a KYC process.
Any business in most developed world can charge Bitcoin for their services and products. Like, that's what we do. So, you know, just earn Bitcoin by selling what you have. Like, it doesn't take much to add the plugin to your shopping cart to start accepting Bitcoin for your services.
Okay, yeah, makes sense.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us, everyone. And thank you to our special guests, NVK and Dave Bradley. And yeah, so we host these monthly spaces on here. And if you follow us at Casa HODL, you can be a part of them. And at Casa, we publish all kinds of Bitcoin content about Bitcoin security. Even if you just like the color purple, give us a follow. And in the meantime, don't trust, verify. Take care, everyone.